Symposium of Critics on Dickens and Great Expectations. Dickens plots George is. The episodic plot is a device to set the characters in new situations to change their relations to one another, and in all of these to make them behave typically as mere arts. The task of the novelist who creates static characters is more like the choreographers than the drama that the dramatists. In this sense, Pickwick Papers has the most satisfactory structure of all. Dickens's novels, because it is more similar to the ballet, in these latter novels an attempt was made to devise more dramatic plots to make the best of two traditions. The art of characterization, Monroe Angel. It must be understood, for it has great relevance to charges of exaggeration often leveled against Dickens, that in his fiction he reported the world very much as he always saw it. Description of scenes and events in his letters sometimes sound exactly like passages of the novels. He always has his eyes on the world around him when he writes, but he sees from a special vantage. The vantage, of course, is the vantage of his unique imagination. Dickens believed that the face is an expression of the human soul. An illustrator should be able to take his cough from the text, and his graphic illustration need only be a kind of verbal illustration of character found in the text. He was at great pains to choose proper illustrations for his novels and to see that the illustration chosen worked closely from the verbal pictures. He provided such a close connection between the character as described and character as drawn would be possible only with as vivid a method of characterizations as Dickens employed. This vividness of characterization, which was part of his talent, also became a matter of literary principle. He said, "You cannot interest your readers in any character unless you have first made them hate or like him. For physical vividness is only an adjunct to moral or spiritual vividness." Interaction of character and plot met in Price. Dickens' characters are remarkable individuals, but they are more than that. It is not often the special case of the unique specimen that the mind dwells. Rather, it is the uniquely intense embodiment of the universal characters, as meaning of the grotesque, as Stocking Horn at Orlick are memorable because of all they include, because of all they deny, because of all they overleap and surpass, and this meaning is conferred upon them by the plot structures of which they are a part. Powerful insight into character, John Forster. What a deal of spoiling, nevertheless, a nature that is really good at, shown in Pip, and the way he reconciles his determination to act very shabbily to his early friends, with a conceited notion that he is setting them a moral example, is part of the shading of a character drawn with extraordinary skill. Pip's greatest trial comes out of his good luck, and the foundations of both are laid at the opening of the tale. In a churchyard down by Thames, as it winds past desolate marshes, 20 miles to the sea, of which a masterly picture in half a dozen lines gives us an average example of the descriptive writing that is everywhere one of the charms of the book. It is in the churchyard that Magwitch, an escaped convict from Chatham, terrifies the child Pip into stealing from him food and the file, and through recaptured and transported. He carries with him to Australia such a grateful heart for the small boy's service that in making a fortune there. He resolves to make a gentleman of his little friend. Peep imagines his good fortune and great expectations to have come from the rich lady of the story. When, therefore, the closing scenes bring back Magwitch himself, who risks his life to gratify his desire to see the gentleman he has met, it is an indescribable horror to the youth to discover his benefactor in the convicted criminal. He too doubts Dickens' power of so drawing a character as to get to the heart of it, seeing beyond surface peculiarities into the moving springs of the human being himself, should closely examine these scenes. There is not a grain of substitution of mere sentiment or circumstances for the inner and absolute reality of the position in which two men, Magwitch and Peep, find themselves. Great Expectations as a work of art, Angus Wilson. Great Expectations surely has more claim to greatness as a work of art. The narrative and the symbol only seem to merge in order to create that totally magnificent atmosphere which is Dickens' greatest achievement in a few scenes. With Magwitch on the marshes, with Magwitch escaping on the Thames, and at Mr. Jagger's sinister dinner party for Peep and his grand friends. Irony and economy are the marks of artistry laid upon the novelist by the followers of Flaubert and Henry James. Great Expectations as them as no other Dickens novels. Yet, if this is what we are after, we cannot really be after Dickens. The plot as symbolism and discovery, Paul Pickerel. The plot is resolved through the discovery of a series of surprising relationships, and each of these is a relationship between something loathsome and something desirable. The first of these is the discovery that Peep does not owe his great expectations to the fairy godmother, Miss Havisham, but to the ogre. Magwitch Peep's rise in the world has not been an act of magic. It has actually been a reward for theft for what he has regarded as the most shameful deed of his life. The second great discovery is that Stella, for whom Peep has wasted his life in loving, is far from being a princess. She is in fact the illegitimate daughter of Magwitch by the criminal who now serves as Mr. Jagger's servant. Miss Havisham is no fairy godmother. She is a foolish old meddler. The revised ending, A.E. Dyson. The revised ending is not a happy ending. It is ambiguous in meaning, yet not in tone. Perhaps Dickens had in mind the conclusion of the Charlotte Bronte's Villette. Though if so, his effect is not quite same. The end of Villette is more desolating than an explicit statement, since who bought the shallowest optimist would adopt the escape provided by Lucy Snow for readers unable to bear her fate. What happens at the end of Great Expectations is less certain. It is barely possible that Peep and Stella marry, barely possible that they are happy if they do. The final words are profoundly satisfying, not because they give certainty about what happens or any clear moral judgment, but because they complete the peculiar music, silvery and autumnal of the tale. Dream and Fairy Tale Elements, Dorothy Van Ghent. In a finely lucid atmosphere of fairy tale, Dickens uses a kind of montage in Great Expectations. A surframing of one's image upon another with an immediate effect of hallucination. That is but one more way of representing his vision of a poorly nervous and moral organization of reality. An instant is the scene in which Stella walks the casks in the old brewery. Stella's walking the casks in an enchanting ritual dance of childhood. But inexplicably present in the tableau is the brewery beam. Accompanying each appearance of Stella, the star and jewel of Peep's expectations, is a similarly disturbing ghost, an image of an unformed dread. The technique of montage is what of dreams which know with awful precision of the affinities between the gulch of our desires and the commonplaces of our immediate perceptions. A World of Fantasy, Edgar Johnson. In spite of its theme of disillusion, great expectations is not in its forwarding atmosphere a melancholy book. Not merely does it move to an ending or a serene of twilight peace, but there are many scenes of high-spirited enjoyment and of the comic gusto Dickens had always been able to command even in the midst of his deepest despair. There is the child Pepys tried into a series of fantastic Hoopers with when Uncle Plum Book is badgering him to tell what happened. At his first visit to Miss Havisham's, and he invents a picture of Miss Havisham sitting in a black velvet coach having cake and wine on gold plates where they feed Bill cutlets from the silver basket to four large dogs. Wave flags and short horns. There is Mr. Upsell's famous performance of Hamlet. There is Trapp's boy imitating the Pepys' progress down to the high street by pulling off his shirt collar, twinging his side hair, sticking an arm akimbo, smearing extravagantly and drawling, "Don't know ya, don't know ya, pun my soul, pun don't know ya." There is Joe's description of how the robots looted the Plumchook's shop.